This program is called The Untrained Eye. Over in London, there's a group that has good time insisting that no matter what anybody says, the Earth is actually flat. Back in the 1960s, when the United States sent its first orbiter around the Earth, it sent back pictures, and the American ambassador thought it would be fun to have the head of the English Flat Earth Society come over and look at them. That gentleman was very kind about it. He came over and looked at the pictures. He said how great they were, and then he said, "It is amazing how, to the untrained eye, the Earth looks round." What was so funny about this was that he was making fun of experts. Every time an expert is shown to be dead wrong by common sense, his response is always, "Well, that's the way it looks to the untrained eye. Only an expert like me understands why what you consider reality doesn't make sense." We say this around us all the time. Whenever people crack down on crime, crime goes down. In Europe, the big drive has been getting rid of the death penalty and being kind to criminals and outlawing guns. We had the same thing in the United States in the 1960s, and Europe is experiencing exactly what we did. The crime rate in Europe is going out of sight. Everybody falls down and worships, especially the respectable conservatives, when somebody mentions diversity. Now, diversity is an unqualified disaster, and any person with common sense can see that. In Europe, once again, the crime rate is going out of sight. They've had chronic unemployment, so they're bringing in millions of immigrants from the third world, and they call it diversity, and they say it's good. They don't give any reason for it. People keep pointing out that it's an unqualified disaster, and their response is, "Yes, to the untrained eye, it looks like an unqualified disaster." So this program is dedicated to the untrained eye. To the untrained eye that sees silliness, facts, and reality. Those of us who were raised out in the country in the Bible Belt have our own sense of humor. I was thinking about one joke that I came up with, and since we were all raised with the Bible, we understand what the joke is. So a lot of us have thought about poor Moses when he had to go back up the mountain and tell the Lord that he had busted up all 10 of the commandments that they had spent so much time writing. I think you all know the story. Moses left his people out in the wilderness and went up onto the mountain with God, and they stayed there for days, and he was facing Jehovah himself, and Jehovah wrote these 10 commandments on stone. Moses marched back down the mountain proudly with the commandments, but while he had been gone, his people, without his leadership, had started worshiping a golden calf. Moses was so infuriated by this that he dashed the commandments to the ground. Now, this is a very important thing, I guess so important that some people can't think of what happened next to Moses the man when he had to walk back up that mountain and look Jehovah straight in the face and say, I busted all of these commandments, all this work that we did together for such a long time up here. If you think of it in strictly human terms, that must have been a very long trip Moses took back up that mountain. And he, of course, like all of us, worried about being chewed out by our boss, the time as he went up the mountain drug by slowly. Well, of course, Jehovah knew what had happened. And I have this idea that since God invented a sense of humor, that he had one too. And when Moses got there, God asked him, "Moses, where are my commandments?" And Moses said, "Well, I broke them." Instead of getting infuriated, Jehovah probably replied, "You broke them? You broke all of them?" And Moses said, "Yes." And Jehovah said, "You broke all 10 of them at one time?" And Moses, quaking in his sandals, replied, "Yes, sir." And Jehovah probably had a little laugh and said, Moses, you don't really do things halfway, do you? Moses is the only person in history who was ever able to break all 10 commandments at one time. There were only 10 of them, but the number of interpretations and books written on those 10 short statements would fill a library. In fact, it does fill a few libraries. Jesus actually cut those 10 commandments down to 2. Love God, treat others as you would have them treat you. Unlike every theologian, Jesus actually shortened the 10 commandments. When Jesus came to earth, there were endless commentaries, thousands of pages, written by the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests of the temple. Jesus didn't expand on the commandments. He shortened them. What all of the people who wrote the Talmud and the commentaries and these endless books seemed to have forgotten was that Jehovah and Moses spent days up on that mountaintop. If God had wanted to expand those commandments into thousands of pages of commentary, it would seem that Jehovah himself could have done that himself. Now, my field of expertise is certainly not religion. My field of expertise is politics. And I live in a country where the founding fathers wrote a very short, practical, common sense constitution. I have also instructed constitutional law. And I have noted that judges have seen fit to expand and expand and expand until a course in constitutional law has nothing whatsoever to do with what we call the Constitution. It has to do with how Judge so-and-so was feeling that morning, if his stomach hurt, if he had read an editorial in the New York Times. I think if the founding fathers had wanted to expand endlessly on what they considered the common sense document they had written, they were perfectly capable of doing so. I did a program called A Living Constitution is a Dictatorship. There are those who say that the Constitution did not mean what it said. It means whatever a judge decides that it said. Now, this leaves us in an odd position, because the United States government is supposed to be a government of checks and balances between the different branches of government, the President, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. But nowadays, we have the idea that when the President and members of Congress take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, what they mean is, we will uphold and defend whatever the Supreme Court decides this week is constitutional. The Constitution that the Founding Fathers wrote has absolutely no validity whatsoever. So, I am a Bible Belter, and what I keep hearing Jesus saying in the New Testament to the scribes, the Pharisees, the priests of the temple is, your opinion is not God's law. Well, my Bible background probably spills over a good deal into my political background. I think that the founding fathers said what they meant. I do not think that the latest opinion of the dictators who happen to wear robes as federal judges constitutes the Constitution of the United States, which was adopted by we, the people of the United States. I do not think that the current opinion or the current commentary of a bunch of theologians constitutes the Word of God. In fact, it is amazing when you think about it how short the Ten Commandments are, or how short the even shorter version that Jesus gave was, or how short the Constitution of the United States is, and in each case, these ideas were transmitted directly to the people with the assumption that, in the case of the Ten Commandments, or Jesus' preachings, or the Constitution, that the people had common sense enough to understand what was being said. To put this in a nutshell, interpretation is dictatorship. When a person says, "This is the word of God," he leaves off three critical words. "In my opinion, this is the word of God." And that is the difference between a dictator and someone who is simply giving his opinion. "In my opinion" are three critical words that everybody needs to put before any statement by anyone. The problem is, of course, that any society that claims to base itself on the Bible, or on God, or on Karl Marx, as Russia did, or on modern opinion, a society that bases itself on a book or modern opinion always ends up looking to a person or a group of people who constitute a dictatorship. This is what I call wordism. People love to say that racism is an evil way to base a society. And by racism, they also mean any basing of a society on a common shared heritage, a commonly shared race, a commonly shared kinship. They say true freedom will come if we base the whole society on the word. And of course, the word varies an awful lot. It can be the word of the Quran, but again, it's not the word of the Quran, it's the word of the imams. It can be the United States is a melting pot based on the Constitution. But by the Constitution, they mean whatever a federal judge said last. That is basing a society on what people call the word. That is what I call wordism. And of course, the problem is the word always ends up being the word as interpreted by some group of dictators. A few years back, a young black man in high school here in Columbia, South Carolina, wrote a paper, which was actually reported in our local newspaper, that said that he was glad that the Constitution was written by a group of middle-aged white men. He said it could not have been written by a multiracial or sexually balanced group. It had to be written by a homogeneous group that was trying to put together something reasonable and not trying to balance off the interests of a bunch of different racial and religious groups. I am ashamed to say I don't have a copy of that news item, because the young man was on to a very important point. The founding fathers were trying to preserve freedom, but there can be no freedom when your job is to force many different racial and cultural groups to live together under the same book or the same version of the Constitution that you have dictated. The proof of this pudding is what we call diversity today. There is no diversity of opinion in a diverse society, precisely because a diverse society has to be based on a unity of opinion. You have many different races, many different groups, and the only way you can unite them is to force them all to repeat a common creed, and that common creed will be whatever the experts, the imams, or the pope, or the elders of the Presbyterian Church or the Marxist theoreticians, be they Chinese or Russian or Albanian or whatever denomination of communism they happen to be, or Ayn Rand, decides it is. Such a society will always have to sacrifice diversity of opinion to diversity of races and cultures. That is the nature of wordism. What really gives me a belly laugh is when some wordist says, yes, but nationalism and racism and dedication to one's culture divides mankind, whereas I, representing my particular book, want to unite all of mankind. Most people are not bright enough to realize what a joke that is. There are only so many nations. There are only, I think, 3 or 4 great races, and maybe 100 actual nations, by which I mean cultural units like France or Scotland or the American South, and by which I mean the real African tribes, which are in fact nations in Africa. So if the cultures of, say, the Irish and the French and the Scots and the Welsh and the Xhosa and the Zulu and the Manika and the Shona and the Cantonese and the Japanese and the Koreans were all to unite separately, they would divide the world into anywhere from 3 or 4 to 100 different groups. But how many universal truths are there? There are thousands of them. Another couple of absolute universal truths will be invented today. There are thousands or tens of thousands of universal truths, every one of which says, if you follow my book, that is to say, my opinion of my particular book, I will unite all of mankind. There's nothing more divisive than wordism. In our politically correct society, nothing could be more shocking than for someone to say universalism is always divisive. Another thing that is a real surprise for someone to say in our politically correct society is to make the point that universalism is also vicious. All we hear about is the viciousness of nationalism, the viciousness of racism. Historically, wordism is far, far more vicious than nationalism or racism has ever been. It doesn't take a genius or a true historical scholar to know what happened to Christianity after the theologians got hold of it. A religion that was founded on the worship of a man who was crucified as a heretic became a religion that actually managed to make what happened to Jesus a lesser agony than what happened to people afterwards in his name. It's hard to imagine anything worse than being tortured for a day and then dying slowly on the cross. But the Inquisition tortured people for days and then burned them slowly alive. Sometimes it stuck them in a rotting prison for the rest of their lives. We all know about the slaughters and the persecutions that have occurred down through the centuries in the name of Jesus. Now, this was after the church became a wordist institution. In fact, there's nothing that the communists did, and they killed over 100 million people in the 20th century. There's nothing that the communists did that they didn't learn from the Christians. In the religious wars, as one example, the 30 Years' War in Germany wiped out 1/3 of the population of all of Germany. The founding fathers were very aware of that. They themselves were also aware of another incident occurred in the same period, which was a little over 100 years before
they reached adulthood, and that was the Salem witch trial, in which witches were hanged rather than burned alive, which is at least some improvement. So the communists, when they came along and they did their mass slaughter, were actually, as people have called them, the bastard children of Christianity. People have called communism the bastard child of Christianity, and for very good reason. Communism promised a utopian society, and therefore anyone who got in the way of utopia needed to be suppressed with any means available. There's a lot of disagreement about how many Ukrainians Stalin starved to death on purpose. The lowest estimate is 5 million. The highest estimate, I believe, is around 22 million. Many liberals went to Russia, and one of them made the classic remark, "I saw no starving peasants," during the years after World War II, when it was illegal in France to deny that one less Jew than 6 million were killed by Hitler. Practically every French, quote, intellectual, unquote, denied that Stalin had killed people or that he had killed many people. In fact, it wasn't until Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago came out that many French, quote, intellectuals, unquote, suddenly realized the extent of the slaughter in Russia. The slaughter in China was a good deal larger, but after all, these people were pushing universal paradise, and there were no limits to what could be done to reach this worldly paradise. Hitler actually didn't do anything that the communists hadn't done better long before him. But we have managed to say, oh, well, the only problem is racism. What we need is a universal philosophy, liberalism, conservatism, Ayn Rand's ideas, or the other 10,000 kinds of utopia or paradise that are always being offered by wordist universalist philosophies, forcing democracy on the rest of the world, meaning our opinion of democracy. All these things have done a lot more killing before nationalism even arose, or racism even arose. In fact, the Spaniards in South America were much crueler to the native population than the Americans in North America. Most of the actual wiping out of the Indians in North America was due to diseases that white people brought over. White Americans took the Indians' land away from them. That is to say, we brought over 100 million to 200 million people to live on land that a few hundred thousand Indians were occupying, and those Indians had taken that land before we did. There are people who live all the way down in Tierra del Fuego, on the bottom of South America. It's an awful place. They didn't end up there because they said, okay, let's go live in a really miserable place at the end of the world, just above Antarctica. They are there because they were driven there. They came across the land bridge up in Alaska when it existed, just like the other Indians, and other Indians behind them kept driving them southward. No, they had a whole hang of a lot of innocence about the whole thing. But when the Spaniards came in, they were not racial bigots. At least their real excuse was that they were religious bigots. The Inquisition, the forcing of Christianity on the native population, these were the excuses for the slaughters and the horrors that occurred in South America. There is a fundamental problem with wordism, no matter how sweet it sounds. In fact, sweeter it sounds, the more of this problem there is. And that is that there is no escape. If you are a true wordist, and you believe in your version of democracy, your version of Catholicism, your version of Calvinism, your version of communism, it doesn't really matter what it is, nobody else has the right to exist outside your system. Your mission is to enforce this all over the world. Now, racists in general, I believe Nazism was a wordist form of even of racism, but racism says different peoples should occupy different lands. This means that there is a place on earth for other races. Universalism, wordism, says that there's no place for other wordism or any other form of wordism. There is no place on earth for racism, for nationalism, for provincialism. There is only room on earth for one universal wordism to unite all mankind. That everybody, that's why they're universal, must be united either by force or by persuasion into this one wordist philosophy, which is your mission, which is your means of uniting society. So there was no place for non-Christians in a Christian world. There couldn't be. Christianity was going to unite all mankind. It was going to lead to paradise. So naturally, they had to get, well, a little bit rough with it. The same thing is true of communism. There is no underlying tolerance in universalism. That's why it's called universalism. And over and over and over and over and over and through the agonizing history and future of mankind, we have seen it and we will see it, that wordism has to wipe out all disagreements. And that is, of course, very much in evidence in our present politically correct form of universalism. Those who insist that our founding fathers wanted to set up a system that they would impose on all mankind have to ignore the preamble to the United States Constitution. We, the people of the United States of America, and our posterity. That was the authority they set the Constitution up on. That is the only declaration of purpose that has ever been adopted by the United States. John Quincy Adams, when he was Secretary of State, told some people who were fighting against tyranny abroad that America is the friend of liberty everywhere, but we are the guardian only of our own. The United States was set up as a nation of a group of people. It was specifically separating itself from another group of people, the British Empire. It was not trying to impose its opinions on the rest of the world. It was not developing democracy as a universal principle. When other people wanted to set up democracies, certainly they were welcome to do so, but absolutely nobody at the Constitutional Convention thought it was our job to spread our idea of democracy or republicanism around the world. That's why they said that the entire Constitution was dedicated to securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. They had already seen enough of people trying to impose their own values, their own Catholicism, their own Lutheranism, whatever it was, on other people, and they wanted no part of it. With just a little bit of wordism, you can twist even the most kind and generous and good statement into something horrible. For example, the Golden Rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So someone says, well, I like liver, therefore I am going to feed liver to anybody I can. I'm not going to let them eat anything but liver until they learn to like it. That is not what Jesus meant. Actually, do unto others as you would have them do unto you is far more complicated than most people think it is, because you have to put yourself in the other person's place. You also have to treat yourself decently. But this is common sense. That is why Jesus said it. He didn't say it so that a bunch of theologians could pick it apart and come up with a universal philosophy for this world. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world." He did not aim for his simple statements to be complicated. They had already been made complicated by the people who eventually crucified him for simplifying them. Jesus did not think he needed a whole lot of interpretation. He was talking directly to the common people and the sinners. When the Ten Commandments were written, as I say, Jehovah could very easily have, in the days he spent with Moses, written 10,000 pages, 100,000 pages of commentary. He wrote 10 short commandments. Wordism can twist anything into something horrible, and it does twist the best wisdom in the world into a horror. There are only two ways that people can be united. One is by kinship, some sort of cultural, national, racial kinship, and the other is by imposing a book, your book, on them. In a world which is wordist, no one can be left alone. The wordist is always a slaveholder. He is always a dictator. He is always an imperialist. That is the nature of wordism. So when all of these people say, well, let's avoid dividing mankind by race or culture or anything else, and let's just all get together on this book I've got here, or this constitution I've got here, and my interpretation of it, they are not being kind. They are not being charitable. They are being vicious. And it is no surprise to me, at least, that every time somebody comes along with the universal solution, the universal book, the universal philosophy, bloodshed and horror come next. And you cannot have free speech as long as people agree that all mankind must be united. Because when they say all mankind must be united, they always have a document or a set of principles that must be imposed on all mankind to unite all mankind. This is common sense. I do love irony, and one of the most ironic things today is that the people who consider themselves modern, educated, and radical think of Karl Marx as the philosopher general. If he was not right on everything, he at least represented modern thought. Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848. He died in 1883. There were a few little things he didn't know, one of which was that every social animal lives in a structured society where there is no equality. All the way from the pecking order among birds to the alpha wolf and the top gorilla, they all live in structured society. All of the females belong to the top one, or at least the pick of the females belong to the top one. So Marx's idea that somehow mankind shouldn't have any social structure, all men were equal, was nuts from an evolutionary point of view. And, of course, from a religious point of view, there isn't any equality in the Bible. When Marx was alive, they had the Rousseau idea that man was naturally a peaceful, equal animal, as shown by the romanticized version of uncivilized men that Rousseau knew about. He, of course, had never seen any of them. That's always a wonderful thing for a wordist, if you haven't actually seen what you're talking about. Up to maybe 15 years ago, it was universally thought that chimpanzees were peaceful animals. Since then, we've had films of them ripping monkeys apart to get the meat. And the whole idea of peaceful, gentle, and above all, equal, being natural, has sort of died. Very few adults now actually believe that, and most of those are in retarded homes. And the idea that man is the only territorial animal, which was universally believed in Marx's time, has also gone by the wayside. But I can remember in the 1950s, when everybody took it for granted at the universities that animals had no borders. Only humans were so selfish and divisive that they would set up borders. Well, at that time, it was thought that the only thing that birds would fight about would be sex. Back to Sigmund Freud's idea that only sex and food or instincts. Well, it turns out there's nothing to that either. It is almost impossible to find an animal, and it is impossible to find a social animal, which does not patrol its borders regularly. Monkeys and chimpanzees actually have patrols on their borders, and they will kill anybody who goes over those borders. Lions have their borders. All animals have their borders. Now, these are the borders that Karl Marx said were unnatural, and only man, because of the capitalist system, had come up with these borders. And, of course, political correctness, desperate to believe this. But the fact is that in order to allow their species to survive, every group of social animals has borders and protects borders and patrols borders. That's why birds make their little chirping noises. It's to warn other birds that this is their territory. So universalism is simply nowhere near nature. There is a place for each group of animals. This has been true of us since about the time we evolved above the level of worms. There is a place for other people in a decent system. There is a place for other people in the philosophy of nationalism. There is a place for other people in a philosophy of racism. There is no place for other people in a philosophy of wordism. Now, what is the alternative to a universalist wordist society? It's called transportation. It's getting better every day. It is not accidental that only one group of countries on the planet Earth have ever surrounded themselves with machine guns, landmines, barbed wire, and the Berlin Wall to keep their slaves in. That, of course, means the workers' paradises, the communist countries. North Korea, China, Cuba, today all shoot people who try to get out. That's because a wordist state has to keep its people in by force. That is why integrationists have to keep chasing white people down with busing, with poverty housing right in the middle of white suburbs. They cannot let people escape. Like all wordist philosophies or wordist rulers, they chase down people in the name of unity. In the name of stamping out racism, What we should have is a very large group of countries, just exactly what the universalist says we should not have. We should have racist countries, nationalist countries, Ayn Randian countries, anything you want. And if you don't like the one you're in, you go to the other one. This is what all those landmines and machine guns, and I saw them many, many times, were aimed at preventing people from escaping the only true faith. I would like a world where you can always move out and you can take your assets with you. If your country becomes unbearable, if you can't straighten the system out, then you leave. And if some other country is willing to accept you, because remember, they're people too. They have a right to live their own lives. But in a last-ditch attempt to fight this rather sane system I have come up with, universalists will say, ah, but you're forcing people to leave their homeland if they want to live in a decent society. Hold the phone here. The whole point of wordism and universalism is that there is no such thing as a home country. Are you talking about a place where people are of the same culture, where people are of the same race? Or are you talking about a place which is just a place? In a universalist world, one more piece of a universalist world. If you reject all forms of nationalism, racism, and provincialism, it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference if someone has to move out of what they call their homeland. If there are lots of countries, then there will be lots of places to go. In fact, if the universalists are right, the ideal country is one that will accept anybody. So there ought to be lots and lots of those where people choose to live a multicultural life. And those will be places where absolutely anybody can go. That's the whole point of a melting pot and open borders. So if we accept the multiculturalist religion that we have under political correctness, there will be plenty of places for everybody to go. Because so many people will opt to live in a nice, open-border, multicultural country. If that's not true, there's something badly wrong with the whole religion of political correctness and diversity that we worship today. That's the kind of world I would like to see. Lots of transportation, lots of countries. You can handle the tariff barriers. Don't worry about your economics. Don't stay awake at night worrying about your economics. Most of the countries are going to have free trade simply because isolating yourself makes a country poor. But if a country wants to, then by all means, it may do so. I don't want to force the Amish to accept automobiles. What we need is transportation. Very complicated concept in the time of Karl Marx, of course. And remember that Karl Marx is considered the latest set of ideas on every college campus. In Karl Marx's time, transportation was very difficult. Today, Americans move all the time. You may not want to leave your home country, but unless you're going to settle for your country being part of some universalist system, this is the alternative. It's called transportation. It's a long word, but it's no longer than universalism. I admit that my ideas are not new and that they are somewhat provincial. I was raised under the United States Constitution, where nobody was allowed, supposedly, to have absolute power. There was local government, there was state government, there was federal government. There was a balance of powers between the different branches of government until the Supreme Court decided that it was the Constitution. There was supposed to be a balance of powers. Every branch of government was required to uphold the Constitution, and that meant that every branch of government had to refuse to take actions which they considered unconstitutional, no matter what the court said.
when the Supreme Court made a decision that he considered unconstitutional, President Andrew Jackson simply refused to enforce it. In fact, the entire basis of the 1860 Republican platform was that they refused to enforce the Dred Scott decision, which allowed expansion of slavery to all Western territories. They would not enforce that part of the Dred Scott decision.
Inside the Soviet Union and inside every communist country, in the past and today, you have to carry an internal passport if you want to leave your hometown. That would have been a horror to the founding fathers, except for one group. That group was forced to stay where it was. That group could be chased down if it tried to escape. But I can say this much for the founding fathers. At least they had the honesty and courage to call those people slaves. Many liberals and many conservatives, including the Wall Street Journal, are so seeped in wordism that they honestly can't tell the difference between the border guards who keep Mexicans out of the United States and the Berlin Wall that kept East Germans inside communist Germany. I wrote a piece in a newspaper in Washington which tried to explain the difference to these dribbling idiots. I pointed out that the Washington, D.C. jail is a place that outsiders cannot go in. It is also a place where inmates cannot go out. But most people understand the difference between being kept out of the D.C. jail and being forced to stay in the D.C. jail. Whenever I argue with a communist, I always point out that every communist country has to build walls to keep its people in. America has to build walls to keep people out. That is because a lot of people would like to live here, and an awful lot of people would not like to live there. Libertarians and the Wall Street Journal have turned freedom into wordism. They are so hypnotized by their slogan of free enterprise and the free movement of goods and services and people that they honestly can no longer tell the difference between being a prisoner in a prison and being a free person outside of a prison. A person who cannot tell the difference between those two things is a total moron. But when you think in terms of wordism and universalism, you're working hard to make a moron out of yourself. These people want to make the whole world free. They want their interpretation of freedom to apply everywhere on earth, and no people anywhere on earth has the right to set up a set of borders around them, no matter what they want. If you will read Joseph Stalin's Constitution of the Soviet Union from 1936, it sounds wonderful. It guarantees freedom of speech. It guarantees every kind of freedom you can imagine. It even guaranteed the right of the Soviet republics to secede from the Soviet Union. The facts under Stalin's rule were just a little different, but the words, the wordism, hypnotized the people who subscribed to it, just as the wordism of libertarianism, the wordism of free enterprise, ends up hypnotizing the people who turn these ideas into forms of universal wordism. The founding fathers were perfectly aware of the danger of wordism. They had seen it in the religious wars. In our century, communism has killed well over 100 million people. In fact, in peacetime, they killed a lot more people than World War I and World War II and Hitler's slaughters all combined. But nobody talks about anything but racism and nationalism and how wonderful it will be when we unify all mankind. The reason for this is simple enough. The people who do the talking in our society are wordists. They're selling something. Universities are selling political correctness. The preachers are selling some theological detail. Very seldom are the preachers actually selling salvation. They spend a lot of time trying to sell themselves, trying to sell their particular doctrine, trying to get their collection plates filled. We all know that. There is a form of wordism which employs almost everyone who does the talking in our society. For wordists, Adolf Hitler was a great blessing. You don't hear people screaming about Japan all the time, but you do hear people screaming about Hitler all the time, whereas the communists have slaughtered a lot more people since Hitler died than Hitler could have even imagined. Pol Pot managed to wipe out a third of the population of Cambodia, which is on a par with the wordist destruction of Germany when the 30 Years' War killed a third of the population of that country. In a civil war over religious doctrines, Catholic versus Lutheran. But nobody even talks about this. They scarcely mention any of these problems. They talk about a Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, a Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, a Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, a Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews all the time. Because no wordist, even though he doesn't think of himself as just another wordist, really wants to get down to condemning wordism. Not really a conspiracy. It's just that if a right-wing theocrat really jumped on wordism, he would have to re-examine what he was trying to sell. It's just that one person is pounding on his Bible, trying to sell the idea that he should rule the world in the name of some theocracy, is not going to point out that the guy who's pounding on Karl Marx, trying to sell the idea that he should rule the world in the name of communism, is a carrier of the same wordist disease that he is. They consider each other somewhat mistaken, but all wordists agree that the point is to determine by which book and which words somebody should rule the world. It never occurs to them that the whole question of a book or a doctrine and a universality that is going to be imposed on all humanity is itself the problem. Wordism is absurd, divisive, murderous, torturous. There is nothing bad that wordism has not done and will not do. It is time that we gave it a name.